And a very happy Super Tuesday to you.
Happy Super Tuesday to all who celebrate, yes.
I did really like that 9 to 5 Mac thing. I thought that was fun.
Oh, the, what was it? Mac Save Mondays.
I know. Taco Bell and LeBron liberated Taco Tuesday for the people. Mr. 40,000, who got a rare Michael Barbaro shout out. Sports rarely ever makes it to the daily. And I do agree with you that also, not that it's not an achievement, but that's kind of a weird thing to kind of get the call out of being like one of the three biggest national stories that requires a shout out. But yeah, good for LeBron.
Yeah, I was surprised.
Yeah, he's got that hustle grind set.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's election day. Democracy's in the air. That's always good. But yeah, not a lot else. Do you want to know why I'm looking forward to this week, or what the biggest news of the week is?
Your move. Not to get too far ahead of things here.
No. We'll get there.
Okay. Then no, I don't.
What happens on Sunday?
Sunday. What is Sunday? Sunday is. Oh God, Fantastical has an update, so I can't even see what.
Fantastical updates itself 3 times a day. Literally, every time I click on it, install update.
Yeah. March 10th, I can now confirm. I have no idea.
The time changes.
Oh, yes.
This god awful. Yes. This has been, I think I've talked about it on the show, and I've definitely talked about it in person, that I become a worse person in the winter. Just like the short days and the darkness just kills any motivation for me.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, daylight savings time is either over or is just starting. I never know which.
Don't care to know. Just starting. Shame on me for not remembering that. I was just thinking about that the other day. I could not be more excited.
Yeah. I didn't realize it. Thank you, Google. It ends on Sunday, November 3rd. So the days will grow darker when.
Literally and figuratively.
Yep. Hey, we got there. Same time. High five. but yeah, so that's that. I'm so excited and I just cannot hide it. All right.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm all full of pep today.
I can tell. Yeah, new apartment, new you.
And I'm wearing that I voted sticker. Oh, did you
that's such a sore spot for me today.
Why? So, oh, well, hold on. Let's talk about it, cuz I want to know, cuz every municipality or area, it's not a uniform national or statewide I voted sticker. So San Francisco has an extremely cute, well-designed one this year, and I'll take a picture of it and show it to you. But Marin is usually a pretty generic one, but it sounds like, so what's the details other than it sounds like you do not have one?
I know I do have one. You are okay. Correct in that it is generic, I think is a good word for
it's
it.
It's like a red thing that says I voted and has like a flag sticker or something.
Yeah, but I do appreciate they send you one. But no, the lady friend and I, we filled out our ballots last night, and then the plan was for me to, drop them off on my way home from the office this evening, which I did. That part went fine. But the other part of the plan was to put the sticker on my way out the door this morning so that I could, you know, wear it through the day and
feel superior.
And right as I was getting onto the freeway, I realized I forgot to do that. So I did not get to wear my sticker today, which was very sad. But at least I did remember the ballots. So that was the important part.
Did you ruefully or regretfully like put it on when you get home to when you like went out to walk the dog so your neighbors don't think you're not disenfranchised?
I did consider doing that.
Are you a low propensity voter?
Yeah. I did consider doing that, but I have actually not left the house since I got home. So, and honestly, all that probably would have happened is I would have put it on. The new housemates would have noticed it and then wanted me to take it off and for one of them to take it. That's probably what would have happened. So,
and so that they could stick it on the window of the backseat of the car.
Exactly. Yeah.
Again, I know apparently that's not a thing in your family, but I still don't understand that. But I know we talked about we were going to create our like technically correct, like our own in-house D2C, what are they called? Play packs? Party packs?
We call them restaurant packs.
So if we were able to do that, but make an example one, or make it a specially like a limited time edition one for election years, where it's like it's a ballot for kids.
It's got a bunch of I voted stickers. I like it. Yeah.
And it's got blue and red. It's got blue and red crayons.
Yep. Yep. Trademark, copyright.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A democracy party pack. Or wait, restaurant pack. Shit.
Get them while you still can. I think that's that too dark for the kids, you think?
A little bit.
Okay.
If the world survives, at the very least, we're leaving them a world ravaged by climate change. So that's what they get for every kids having everything be disposable. These are their carbon emissions. Follow up. I've done this a couple weeks, but we still got it.
Yeah.
You lead follow up, because I actually haven't taken a very close. I've been busy, so I haven't taken a super close look at the agenda.
How dare you? So I guess I'll break this out into. Well, we'll do a quick one first. So you're the number one fan of the whole continuity camera on Apple TV now. So this is where you can use your iPhone to FaceTime or Zoom or whatever on the Apple TV. But one of the downsides, which I think you had a chef special even maybe where you found some third party thing to use as a mount for your phone.
It was a weird feature that it didn't come out with any type of like corresponding hardware. Not that it was like implied or required that Apple should create like some type of like camera bar or sound bar with integrated camera, but like there wasn't even kind of the thing when Continuity Camera came out on the Mac, and there was a thing like co-designed with Belkin to make it work well. Yeah, it was totally absent from that. But is there somebody now make something?
Yeah, so that's what you would have thought they would have done with the Apple TV when that feature came to it, which they did not do initially, but is what they've done now. So it's surprise, surprise, it's Belkin again. They've come out with something which looks, very similar to the thing that you can put on top of your MacBook or your cinema display. But this thing now has like a little stand that you can put it down on like the table. If your TV is like on a console table or something, you can clip it to the top of your TV, or you can also somehow like wall mount it. The 9to5 Mac article, which will be in the notes, says that it can be magnetically attached to a wall. I'm not really clear how that would work, but
I assume it means that you then have to stick like a little magnetic. It's kind of like, how people have MagSafe mounts in their car, where you just have this thing that's got like 3M sticky tape on the back that you adhere to the dashboard, which is probably not good, great for paint, but
or potentially for your phone if that fails. But
mobile accessories never move on, so I'm sure that'll be permanent for 30 years. And this 9to5 Mac article, to call back to the opener, this is where who is this? Zach Hall, MagSafe Mondays, make it a thing.
Yep.
But I'm assuming it's $45. Like everything from Belkin's $45.
I think by law everything for Belkin, is $39.99 and up.
$49.95. Oof. Biden's economy. Yeah.
Yeah, I've still not used the continuity camera feature.
You should try it.
I haven't used it on my Mac either, but I've not used it on the TV.
Do you FaceTime with anybody to like show the kids?
We do really just a couple of different family members. Yeah.
The next time you do, because I'd be curious as to how, because like I think center stage in this instance, like on iPads and especially on like the potato camera of my studio display, or cinema display, whatever this thing's called, like it's not very good, but using the camera of the 14 Pro, like it's so good at, so I'd be really curious as to how it does with wiggly humans. Like I want to know how it would track. Yeah, so I mean, I don't know. If you guys want to be patient, I would really recommend giving that a try and let me know how it works.
Okay. Yeah. I guess we have talked about that before. I think I've made the same joke before. I'd worry a little bit about giving like my poor grandma motion sickness by having the.
It's very gentle. Well, like it's got like a really nice. It's got like a nice cinematic sweeping pan. It's not just like darting around. Like if you're moving too wackily, it ignores it.
Have you tested it with a 4-year-old and a 1.5-year-old running around the room?
I was doing some tests on it where I feel like my body movements might have emulated them.
Oh, let's leave that at that.
Wait, what? I don't even know what that could mean, and I think that means I'm a better person.
Oh dear.
I literally don't know. Okay. Anyway. Anyway, neat. Somebody did post a thing I think that was vaguely related to this, or maybe something different, but they did, I think they had the same TV as we do, where somebody's mentioned, yeah, probably not for TFO or with TVs that are like 0.3 inches thick at the top.
Well, I was thinking about that with OLEDs, because I would imagine with the newer LG OLEDs, I mean, I assume those are even a little bit thinner and have like even smaller like bezels than our TVs do. So yeah, it doesn't seem like this would be a great fit for that. Like you'd have to go the wall mount or tabletop method, it seems.
I think other manufacturers aren't like LG. Like I think the Happening TV, like the one that Nilay Patel advocates for, is like the Sony Bravia A80 or something. And I think that one, they don't take quite like an LG-like approach, where the TV itself is thicker. It's still not like plasma thick, but it's not, they don't do the half of it is ultra, ultra, ultra thin. And then you've got this kind of like hump where the electronics are. It's more spread out. So I think it's only LG that does kind of that weird, hey, let's make sure people know how cool and small this technology is.
It's the old, what's now the old MacBook Air style versus the new MacBook Air style. I get it.
Yeah. I did find it funny, just follow out from Upgrade, is when Mike was saying that his wife kind of thought that the old MacBook Air design was better. It is kind of, even though it does look dated, I do think the wedge shape was actually kind of more interesting and felt smaller. That was an interesting data point.
Yeah, I was thinking of the word interesting as well. I don't know if it is necessarily better, but I do think it's more interesting.
Yeah, I think like in our minds, it's probably marred by the fact that like the original 13, like the non-Retina MacBook Air, just had like gigantic fucking bezels. Like there was a lot of like stray aluminum around the screen. But I feel like there could have been a way they had modernized that. But I mean, the current one's great.
Didn't the very first one, didn't like the ports have like a little flip out door?
Yeah, and if you did anything that required any type of processing power, it would underclock itself. And it had a 1.8 inch iPod hard drive in it. Yeah, it was a flawed machine.
And it had like it had like what, like the whatever like Intel's mobile processor was at the time or something.
It had an almost like netbook quality. It was a stepping stone. It was like the first gen Vision Pro. It's you're gifting Apple your money because you're building the future,
wasn't it?
And nobody should ever ask you how often you use your $4,000 face computer.
we'll get to that. Wasn't it also like hilariously expensive too?
I remember seeing it when it originally came out, and it started at $2,600. And then there was like a really kind of funky SSD enabled option. It was like an extra 500, but the SSD I think was like comically small. I think it was like 64 gigs, which even for like 2008 times was not really enough for OS X.
But also like, so 2600 USD in, what'd you say, 2000 like 7?
2009, let's go with that.
2009 in 2024 dollars?
3700.
Oof. Yeah.
That's fine.
Oof.
Yeah. amortization.org. What is this? All right. I never trust these because it doesn't actually cut, like, because, you know, if you just say like what is 360 centimeters in inches, like Google itself will tell you. But all of these are just like weird SEO things where it's like random websites. Like this comes from in2013dollars.com. That seems, I don't know.
In follow-up, a couple of quick streaming things and then potentially a slightly longer follow-up topic. So the big sports Hulu thing, joint venture thing between Warner Brothers Discovery, Fox, and Disney. At least Warner Brothers Discovery has come out and said that there will be an option where you can bundle in Max into the sports bundle. And, you know, presumably there's going to be sort of the same thing from Disney. And this is all just further evidence of what we've been saying forever, which is we're just going back to cable TV, but with a worse user experience and probably paying more than we used to. So, yay.
Mm-hmm. But also, to his credit, I mean, I think if you'd ask David Zaslav if, like, you could roll your Max subscription into, like, a Denny's meal, he would say yes to that, too.
Probably so. I mean, if it helps free cash flow, he'd be, yeah, be all about it.
Didn't you see in one of the earnings report, I think Lucas Shaw called this out, where they now have the streaming division of WBD as being, like, cash flow positive or something, but they invented some, like, weird accounting metrics to make that happen. And,
well, yeah, because he restructured the company to make, like, whatever, yeah, metrics his bonus is based on better, which, you know, chef's kiss to that. Oh, man.
Good guy.
Yeah, real likable, I've heard.
Is he bad?
I don't think he's bad in that way. But
I always thought that he just sucked in the sense that, like, he doesn't want to, like schmooze and try to, like, play.
That's what I mean. Talent. Yeah, he's not a problematic figure, but I've heard.
Yeah. I always did wonder, like, because he was a Discovery guy, or he was like scripts.
He was head of that before the Warner Brothers merger. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'm like, but wasn't Discovery the weaker company, or were they both weak?
I think with Warner Brothers, like, dead. I don't really know. I guess it depends on how you measured it. But yeah, I think it was like Discovery's basically whole management team that came over and took over the what's now Warner Brothers Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And then a last quick bit of streaming follow up. This is about the whole Diamond Sports RSN bankruptcy proceeding, where, like, Amazon's going to be making this big investment. One of the things that was speculated on, which we commented on when this kind of came back into the news a month or two ago, was the Bally's naming potentially going away through this bankruptcy process. And that's, I guess, now been confirmed. Diamond Sports submitted their official reorg plan to the bankruptcy judge. And one of the things that was called out there is that they're going to void out the Bally's or the contract with Bally's for the naming rights. So,
hey, so there is actually a silver lining to the story.
Yeah. So hopefully a good thing, although I will have to see what the new name is first. I mean, we could end up with FanDuel something, but we'll see.
But real quick on that, do you have that article open?
I do. Mm-hmm.
So go down to the paragraph where it says, as part of the proposed reorg. The part, actually, I read this before and I wasn't entirely clear. Is Bally's paying them to use the name, or are they paying to use the name? Which direction is the money going?
I think it's going from Bally's to Diamond Sports.
Yeah, because I can't imagine why Diamond Sports would pay.
Yeah.
To use that.
Yeah, no, it's like with, like, arenas. It's the company that's paying for that, right? So I think the same idea here.
Got it.
And now so Diamond Sports, which is, you know, basically, I guess what it's doing through this bankruptcy proceedings is working to become its own company. So it's looking to you know, break itself away from Sinclair. And so, yeah, whatever streaming services or cable channels, or, like, you know, basically whatever Diamond Sports ends up becoming, the name of their channels and services will no longer have Bally's in it. So potentially good news. Last bit of follow up. Before you got to start driving, I'm not as good at driving as you are. there's been a couple of different interesting articles and videos talking about, you know, we're a month into Vision Pro and the topic of, you know, how much are people using the their Vision Pro a month in. And I think it was last episode maybe where I kind of said something that I wish I had maybe even said like before Vision Pro came out, which is like my number one prediction would be there's a lot of buzz when this thing first comes out, and like a month in, nobody's going to be talking about it because nobody's really going to be using it. And that kind of seems like what's happening now. There'll be a link in the notes to a interview with Joanna Stern of the Wall Street Journal where she basically says she's reaching for it less and less. There was the moment on Upgrade this week where
can you describe it, or can you give as much detail as possible?
Well, so it in the Ask Upgrade section, it was asked how often Jason and Mike use the Vision Pro in a typical day. And I don't know, Jason went on this whole thing about how he doesn't really have a typical day. I'm not really even sure what that meant.
The basis was that he resented the question.
Yeah.
Because he felt like it was a judgy leading question. Because people are just asking like, because I think, and you pointed this out as well, is that it sounded like the person was asking it in earnest of like, just, hey, how much are you guys how many hours a day, or how does this fit? I think it was like coded as, how does this fit into your, have you like a month in?
Right.
How have you found this fits into your life? And then Jason got really mad, like not angry, but like just, you could tell that he was like irritated by the question and went on this whole thing about, well, there's no such thing as a typical day for me. And then some days I use it a lot. Some days I don't use it at all. And I think he ended up saying, I use it less than I did or something. It's a real fun listen, just because it felt like it came from like a place of defensiveness, which, I mean, the Vision Pro is a toy, and that's, it's cool to like your toys, but yeah, I thought it was fun.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I think we are kind of where I thought we'd end up, which is I don't hear a lot about the Vision Pro, and I suspect we're going to hear about it less and less. And I guess my prediction for the rest of the year would be it'll get a, you know, I don't know, 10-minute, 15-minute long segment in the WWDC keynote this year. People will get briefly excited about that through the developer betas over the summer, and then it will kind of fizzle out again. But I think what the main, one of the main takeaways is that it's a neat tech demo, but it's just not very practical for everyday use. Both because of its comfort or lack thereof, and because of how isolating it is. Mm-hmm. And because it just doesn't, it's not really clear outside of maybe watching a movie what's genuinely better about using it than a Mac or an iPad or whatever.
Yeah. Show me a use case that is not media consumption.
Yeah.
In a solitary environment where it is better than a appropriately spec'd Mac or something.
I don't know if you've picked up on this. Even media consumption, which does seem like it's genuinely really, really good with it. I've still, through all like the podcasts I've listened to and articles I've read, I've still actually not heard of anyone sitting down and watching a full movie in it. Anytime I've heard or read about someone referencing watching a TV show or movie with it, they always say like, oh, you know, I watched 10 minutes of this, or I watched like half of that. Like, nobody actually even seems to be able to keep this thing on for a full 2.5 hour movie.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. So no, but this Wall Street Journal, or this CNBC interview with Tech Jojo was fantastic. One other thing that's vaguely related to this that I did want to bring up, I don't know if it appears elsewhere in the doc yet, but I'll send you a link. Has Ming-Chi Kuo fallen from grace, or not, or is he no longer in like the top tier of the supply chain and like the Apple stuff?
Not that I know of.
Because this report seems not like nonsense. Like, So he says that Vision Pro demand is higher than expected. It's supposed to be at U.S. shipments for 2024. Supposed to be 250,000 units versus the prior estimates of like 175,000. And here's the part that I think is absolute bullshit, which is that returns of the product are below 1%. That is impossible and wrong. Like, even iPhone has for data points I can't say, like, even your average tech product probably has a return rate somewhere in the 10% or less, but higher, much higher than 1%. I do not believe that. Yeah, I think that's crazy. And that's the part where, has Ming-Chi Kuo really had like a scoop or a real lead on something that was correct in a while? I don't think so. I think it's all been 100% German recently.
Kind of feels that way. Yeah.
But it is no chance that the Apple Store is seeing only one out of every 100 customers return the Vision Pro when they realize, oh, this doesn't really do anything. All right. Want to blaze through some EV stuff?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. I think the biggest stuff is that wasn't it last week that the Ford, or sorry, is it just Ford or is it everybody that got access to the NACS enabled, like there's a subset of Tesla superchargers that have been designated as accessible to NACS, like non-Tesla vehicles. Is it just Ford right now or is it everybody?
So it's just Ford right now. So yeah, there's kind of a lot to break down with this.
Yeah, it's not simple.
It's not, no, it's definitely not simple at all. So, and it's not even, it's even more complicated than what it seemed like initially, which already sounded kind of complicated. So Ford, if you can remember, was the first auto manufacturer to announce that they were going to be adopting the NACS plug type, which is the Tesla plug. And as part of that, they were going to get access to the supercharger network, which, you know, maybe that's the first point to clarify, which is just because you install an NACS plug in your car doesn't mean you automatically get access to superchargers. That, you know, you've still got to then make a deal with Tesla and, you know, get all the software interoperability stuff figured out. But so far, basically every car manufacturer has come out with the same kind of press release that Ford initially did, which is they're doing two things. They're both adopting the NACS plug type and they're making a deal with Tesla to grant their cars access to the supercharger network. I don't think there's been anybody who's come out and just said they were adopting NACS but did not cut a deal with Tesla. But anyway, Ford was the first one to announce that, and so they're now the first ones to actually put this into action. So the first part of it is any existing F-150 Lightning or Mach-E owner can now, I guess you have to buy this. It's a $230 adapter, which is a CCS to NACS adapter. CCS is the plug type that current Ford EV and all non-Tesla EV cars have, and that's what they'll need this adapter until Ford and other manufacturers start making cars that have the NACS plug, you know, out of the box, so to speak, built into the
car.
Real quick.
Mm-hmm. So actually, that was something I was going to ask. Are the F-150 Lightnings that are rolling off the assembly line, if you get a brand new one, is it likely to have the NACS
built into it,
or is that still not a thing?
No. So nobody yet outside of Tesla is building NACS plugs directly into their cars. In fact, nobody's even announced a specific car that's going to have that plug type. All Ford and everybody else has been saying is
like a commitment to the
commitment. And I think some of them, I think including Ford, have said starting with modeled like 2025 year cars, that's when you're going to start seeing that. I actually think this week we'll probably see the first specific model announced with this, which is on Thursday, Rivian is announcing, I forget what the model is, but it's basically like
they have like a new, it's kind of like the S and the X were Tesla's like, not proof of concept, but they're high-end cars, and there's going to be kind of the slightly mass-market cars. So it's the R2S.
Exactly.
Is there cheaper-ish ones?
Yeah, so that's going to be announced on Thursday, and my guess would be that's going to become the first car that's going to be officially announced with an NACS plug. The reason I think that is because that car is not coming out until 2026 is the rumor, so it just kind of makes sense that they're going to probably just say that that's what it's going to have. So with the Ford stuff, there's some interesting parts to this. The most interesting, I think, is, and I think I made this comment to you offline online, when Ford and others announced that they were going to gain access to the supercharger network, one of the things that stood out to me, because hi, I'm an accountant, is the number of supercharger stations they were saying they were going to have access to was not equal to the number of supercharger stations that exist. Mm-hmm. And I was like, at the time, like trying to figure out, I couldn't quite figure out why those numbers didn't add up. But now that Ford's going to start having access to the supercharger, one of the things that's happened is Tesla has updated their supercharger website. And specifically what they've updated is they're calling out that it's actually only going to be certain supercharger stations that are going to be open to non-Tesla vehicles that either have one of these CCS to NACS adapters, or in the future, just have an NACS plug built right into the car. And then there are going to be other supercharger stations that continue to be exclusive to Tesla cars.
And for a minute, wasn't there a thing where like Tesla, it had like a very Apple name, like Tesla had like a extremely small number? Because yeah, even MKBHD had a video about this, where they had things called like a magic dock, where there was actually inside the supercharger, it had like an adapter there to unlock. Was that just basically not a thing they're going to do anymore?
So that was announced and started to be rolled out in a world that predated everybody adapting or adopting NACS. My guess with the magic dock thing, which is what you're referring to, is that, do you remember that Tesla, I think it was actually in California, briefly had the idea that instead of charging your car, you would just hot swap the battery. So they had a proof of concept location. I think it was in like Harris Ranch, in California. And you drive your Tesla up, they would take the battery out and put in a fully charged battery, and then on your return trip, you would get your original battery back. And that lasted not very long and never expanded. I kind of think that's what the magic dock's going to be, is it'll be something that was a good idea in a different era, but will probably kind of fizzle out in favor of the NACS stuff.
Well, I'm sorry, wait. So that battery swap thing, was that before or after Tesla said you couldn't buy out your vehicle lease because all of them were going to become robo-taxis that drove themselves and made money while you were at work?
Oh, when they were an appreciating asset, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that was before.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. So I'm on, I don't know if there's an easy way for me to share this link with you, but in the Electric article that'll be in the notes, they link to Tesla's supercharger website, which is actually nice and very clearly laid out. And when one of the things they now clearly call out are stations that are
open to NACS. Yeah, I see it.
Yeah, open to non-Tesla cars versus those that are not.
So if I'm at tesla.com/findus. Wait, so do you happen to know the difference between superchargers open to other EVs and supercharger open to NACS? Why are those different things?
So I believe, I was trying to figure that out too. I believe superchargers open to other EVs are the stations that have the magic dock, because those are the only supercharger stations where
Oh, that's why there's only like four dots on the entire map for that. Okay.
Exactly. And that's where you can have something like a Rivian, and even without having one of these, you know, CCS to NECS adapters, because of the Magic Dock, which basically has that same type of adapter built into it, you can still use a supercharger. But
not,
yeah,
my Kettleman City, goodness.
That this it's like you and I have been doing this for over a decade. So Kettleman City was exactly the example I was going to use, because, you know, as someone who has made the drive to Southern California in a Tesla many, many, many times over the last few years, Kettleman City has been one of the places
that
lounge,
we... right?
Yeah, which we walked through once and was like, yeah, this is kind of lame. But it is a very convenient stop because it's got a very large number of stalls, has like a nice restroom and stuff. But anyway, I feel...
Roman, what's that other city on the 5 going down to LA that has a gigantic supercharger array and also like an outlet mall and a bunch of food choices? What's that one called?
You're describing like four or five different locations now.
Oh, I'm thinking of Tejon Ranch.
But, yeah, okay. that's another
okay. That's a
common one that we should look at that next maybe. But you start with, so with Kettleman City, I feel like this is a really good example of what's happening here. So they have their original supercharger there, and then a year or two ago they basically built like a second one like just down the street. And there are a number of other locations that have similar examples to that. And it seemed kind of odd at the time. I mean, you could kind of explain it away with, well, yeah, I mean, they need more and more capacity. So, you know, and if they have locations where there is additional space located nearby, they just kind of, you know, logically expand there, which I do think is part of it. But I think the other part of it too is now the strategy is you've got, you know, basically like half of your stalls available to Tesla cars only, and then you've got another section that's available to other EVs. So like Kettleman City is a really good example of that. Let's kind of go down I-5 here, because Tejon Ranch is actually another example where there's basically like two stops. Yeah, it's in Tejon Ranch is the same thing, where one of the stations is still Tesla exclusive, and then the one across the freeway is open to everybody. So yeah, kind of interesting. I mean, it does seem like, you know, there are a, you know, very large number of stations that are open to other EVs. I mean, just eyeballing the map, it seems like it's, you know, close to like 50-50. Which, yeah, I mean, I guess overall seems like kind of a reasonable approach. I mean, obviously, like, as somebody whose, you know, next car is certainly not going to be a Tesla, but will be an EV, like, I would love to see every supercharger station opened to non-Tesla cars. But I mean, I get why, you know, that wouldn't be the case.
All right. And then the other quick EV bits, get back to the dock. I actually don't have a ton to add about this, but maybe you can throw some links in the show notes. There's been a couple of like longer-ish articles about, there's been kind of, I can't even know how to describe it, but like the tide, or like the public opinion tide against, or in favor of, or against EVs has kind of turned over the past 9 months. And there's been like a couple of articles that are explaining, like, there used to be a, like when the F-150 Lightning came out, like, because they used this, the like antiquated dealer model, like you had a bunch of sketchy dealers that were trying to capitalize on the hype and were marking up like $10,000 every single car that they could. And now the F-150s are sitting on a lot, and there's just been kind of like just a very bad PR period for electric vehicles, and especially in the higher interest rate environment, is certainly not helping cars that are still, even some of the cheaper ones, if you get it equipped nicely, is gonna be in like the high 50s and above. So yeah, they're decent reads, but I read them 2 weeks ago, so honestly don't have a lot to talk about right now.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the last time we talked about this, we were talking more about how we thought one of the big mistakes were the car manufacturers focusing on vehicle types that just didn't really appeal to all that many people.
Hummer EV aside, is the Mach-E a high? What is the cheapest Mach-E you can get?
Well, so with the crossovers,
are what people want.
With the most, yeah, but I would push back with the Mach-E being a crossover. It's too small to be a crossover, I think. But anyway, I think now with the most recent price cut, it starts at like 39 something.
Yeah, like a lot of them got like, yep, literally just $8,000.
But so I didn't do ton of research here, but I did do a little bit of digging, and so like even with something like the Mach-E or I would actually use the Ford F-150 Lightning because it actually better fits my narrative here, but you know, so number one, right, like the percentage of, when you look at total cars sold, the percentage of new cars being sold, which at this point, like almost all EVs are new. I mean, there are obviously becoming more and more used, but because they're, you know, relatively new overall, most EVs are being sold as new cars. That's a very, very small part of the market. So that's kind of like economics problem number one. And then the second problem is, so I quickly looked this up. Like the average new car costs per price in the U.S. is a little over $48,000. So when you look at something like the F-150 Lightning, even after its most recent price cuts, which were pretty significant, it still starts at $50,000. So it's, you know, it's still a very, very expensive car. And the Mach-E, you know, it starts at a little under $40,000 with its most recent price cut. But that's, you know, that's for a rear-wheel drive only. And again, it's basically like a slightly bigger sedan. So, I mean, these cars they're just really, really expensive. I mean, there's just
no, very few end users care. If you asked a random person who rolls up in a Ford Fusion or something whether their car is front wheel drive, rear wheel drive, or all wheel drive, nobody's gonna know. So the fact that the cheap Mach-E is real, I think that means literally nothing to 95%.
Oh, I didn't mean to focus on that part of it. But I mean, even okay, so even like with the Mach-E, you know, like the select all wheel drive version is like 43,000. So still, I mean, just like that's just really, really expensive for what that car is. So, I mean, yeah, it's not breaking news or that hot of a take, I don't think, but I mean, the EVs are just too expensive. And well, and then on top of that, they're priced out of, you know, most consumers' budget. Yet still, these car manufacturers are losing just comical amounts of money on every one of these they sell. So, I mean, the economics are just completely out of whack with them right now. So, I mean, of course, you know, especially in an economic environment where profitability and efficiency are, you know, being emphasized, like EVs don't fit into that.
Wait, so when is an economic environment where profitability is not emphasized?
I'm kidding.
Well, but that was only for a certain type of business. I don't think like legacy companies get the affordance of grow fast, worry about making money later. I don't think that applied to Ford.
Nah, but I think in the times when Ford and others announced their ambitious EV plans back in the, you know, 0% interest rate world, I do think they similar to tech companies, would have gotten a lot more leeway. And now that, you know, interest rates are very different and the economy overall is very different, that leeway kind of evaporated.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I just think that overall too, right, there's just this realization that these cars are way too expensive for most people. Even at those really high prices, they're nowhere close to being profitable. And there's like, that's not a problem that's going to be fixed this year, next year, in the next couple of years, right? So
I really disagree with your point about the cars are too expensive. Like, the fact that they're losing money, that is absolutely, like, even once they get the volumes up, that's still going to be a problem. But like, you go to Sonoma a bunch, right? Like, you see all of these like people with like pickup trucks that are never going to touch anything other than pavement. Like an F-150, if you get it with all like the crap that people get, like the cars are very expensive. So the fact that the Mach-E is $40,000 or that the Tesla Model 3 is like 46 or whatever, they're not that expensive. There's certainly no Toyota Corolla equivalent EV at the moment, but I don't think the price is really what's stopping people. They haven't cracked the range anxiety thing. There's other stuff going on.
I would super push back on that though, because even with like Ford, you look at, I don't know, like another car in their lineup, like the Escape, let's say, which sure, I think is objectively a more functional car than the Mach-E. I mean, it's $10,000 less.
For Americans, that doesn't matter.
What do you mean?
Like, look at what Americans buy. Like, again, like cars keep getting more and more expensive. Like, yeah, like what does the average car that comes off the lot these days cost? It's like 45,000. Like, yeah, didn't you cite a statistic earlier?
Like 48,000 is the average new car price.
So yeah. What is the Escape, if you buy one that's not the one with cloth seats and it's just like super crappy, how much is it? The Platinum starts at $37,000.
Well, yeah, I guess premium,
how much is an okay-ish Mach-E?
An okay-ish Mach-E seems like it's in the like 45 to 50 range.
Yeah, I don't think that's that much of a difference. I think the reason people are not buying EVs is not because $5,000 to $7,000.
I assume
Ford can come up with some bullshit calculator like Tesla did. Because isn't Tesla's like payments estimator like have a weird sketchy thing that says, oh, but all the gas savings is going to be your effective monthly rate? It's like, I assume Ford can also play that game. Anyway, there's more, and this is where the whole doom and gloom negative PR cycle about EVs right now is kind of, that's why I think that is surprisingly interesting, because I do not think it's simply price. I do think there is no quintessential example of a really affordable $27,000 Corolla or Hyundai, what's the cheap Hyundai? Hyundai Sonata. Level car. We haven't gotten there yet, but there's other stuff that's causing people not to buy these vehicles.
Oh. Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're right that there's a bunch of other things you can point to, but I just think for most people, these cars are just out of their budget, as are new cars in general.
Oh, sure.
But that's particularly a problem with EVs, because there's not some, you know, huge robust used car market for them yet.
Well, I mean, that'll fix itself. But I mean, that's just time.
Yeah.
But on that note, allegedly, there is going to be a Chevy Equinox EV that gets 320 miles of range and will start at $35,000. And I'm going to skim this article and assume ships in 18 months, probably.
You're talking about the Equinox?
Yeah.
I think there's one version of it, which is allegedly coming out sometime later this year. But then, yeah, like the more affordable trims are next year, maybe. When this article came out, I actually started paying a little bit more attention to just because, I mean, obviously Chevy makes the Equinox today, like in a gas version. I don't like the look of that car. I think maybe we talked about this last time too. There's just something about like most Chevy cars where I don't really like the look.
Do you think the Model 3 looks good?
Ish.
Do you think the new Model 3 looks good?
Looks better. But I wouldn't say it's like a spectacular looking car. No.
You don't ever watch Netflix movies, do you?
Or movies in general. No.
All right, Mr. Dark Knight. Have you ever heard of a movie called Leave the World Behind?
Is that like, who am I thinking of? The famous actress.
Charlize Theron.
No, not her.
Emma Watson.
What is it? Where's
Bradley Cooper?
Where's Call Sheet when I need it? Julia Roberts is who I'm thinking of. Yeah, it's like her. It's an all-star cast, but no, I've not seen it.
It's not a very good movie. You never watched the TV show Mr. Robot either, did you?
No.
That was actually a pretty good show. Like I know there's zero chance you ever watch it, but it was pretty good. But the guy who made it made a movie about kind of like not crypto, but it was like a modern like what happens if technology goes wrong movie. And this is not a spoiler because it's been on social media a million times, but there was a scene where a bunch of self-driving Teslas just, when the world ends, just start driving off lots and crashing into each other. And it's a fun watch.
Mm.
But it did remind me that just the Model 3 is a, maybe it's just a living in Northern California thing. This also goes back to, and I don't think we ever brought it up, but Rivian had like an earnings announcement and they announced how many cars they sold. And then like they shipped like 20,000 cars last year. And I was mentioning to somebody else that like, I assume 96% of those deliveries went to the Bay Area because like Rivians are very visible and popular here.
Very, very much so. I see a very surprising number of R1Ss around. Like it's become like a daily thing now, I've been surprised by.
Yeah, it is weird that Newsom passed that law where you're legally required to get an obnoxious license plate if you have an R1S. But
yeah, that did seem like
the way Democrats do it.
Seemed like government overreach to me. The
nanny state,
wokeness.
I don't think I've ever heard you say that word.
You may never hear me say it again.
Yeah, Leave the World Behind. It's an okay movie. And then I was talking about something else, but I already forgot it. Wait, what was Rivian about? I forgot. It doesn't matter. Okay, move on to something new.
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah.
Okay. This week, I moved a little bit. And that's always fun because that gives you a chance to reevaluate your smart home setup.
So not to interrupt right away, but so moving a little bit. What is that? How is that different from a regular move?
You know why, and there's no way to not OPSEC reasons.
No OPSEC, yeah.
Correct. I moved a little. I moved stuff a little bit.
You moved to a different unit in the same building. I don't think that's not too specific, right? We can cut that out if it is.
Sure. Let's go with that. So yeah, I did reevaluate a couple of smart home things, and that's always fun. Also, because the lighting is different, had to look at my Hue setup a little bit. And I guess I was reminded when I had to buy some new light bulbs that Hue lights are still extremely expensive and inflexible.
Mm-hmm.
So my dining room / living room lighting fixture has 6 bulbs in it. And they are $45 a pop, even if you buy it on Amazon.
Yep.
And it's really irritating to spend $260 with tax to make a single light fixture smart. That stinks. Mm-hmm. I always thought that Hue lights, what is Zigbee? I always thought that meant that there was somehow going to be like third parties that made stuff that was at least mostly compatible with the Hue ecosystem, but I don't think there is.
No, Zigbee is just the, I think it's just like the radio type, like similar to how the hot new thing now is Thread. I think Zigbee is like OG Thread.
But then why can't somebody else make a Zigbee light?
Well, because I don't know if everybody's like implementation of Zigbee has to be the same. I don't really know. I definitely get you saying the Hue stuff is expensive. That is definitely true. But I don't quite follow the them not being open part, because
I said inflexible. Now my problem is that just one, this could be a rehash of a lot of old issues, but it comes to the forefront whenever you take on a new project. The Hue app fucking sucks so bad. And like, one, I turned it on and it only found 5 of the 6 lights and it gave them random ass names, and then it assigns them to the wrong room. And then I clean it all up and it's great and it's fine now. Good. So then I go over to the Apple Home app, and I have to redo it all again. And it just doesn't sync up. So it just threw like all of those kitchen lights into like hallway, which is no longer a room that I have. Like it stinks. And also in the Hue app, even if you were to just pretend that, hey, let's just use the first party app, there's no way to that is actually one thing I like about the Home app, is that there's no way to say that 6 lights are one light. Like in this setup, there's no reason I would ever want one bulb not to be doing what the other 5 are. There's no way in the Hue app itself to do that. You can have them in a room, you can program a scene, but there's no way to just say, hey, you 6 are the same thing. That's dumb. That's silly. It's not very good. And then the iConnect Hue app is like this weird necessary evil. Like it's fiddly and really rough software. And I appreciate that it exists because it fills a need, but just a lot of it sucks. And for the cost, I feel like it should suck less. I don't know. And then what else? I don't know. Like,
I agree overall the Hue app is bad. I almost never ever interact with it. But like I guess you're technically right that you can't group individual bulbs to be like a single device, similar to how you can like in the Apple Home app. But like right on the homepage of the Hue app, you can turn on and off rooms, which has the effect of turning on all of the bulbs at the same time. But I guess what you're saying is there's no ability to like turn on an individual fixture with multiple bulbs in the same room.
Exactly. That's the whole point.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, the Hue app is bad.
And mostly so in my living room, I have 4 Hue things. I have the little Hue Play ambiance thing behind my TV. I've got a freestanding floor lamp. I've got that, the 6 bulb thing, and then some other thing. Like, I wouldn't want to say, hey, just turn off this entire room. Like, I would want to be able to, like, depending on where I am or what I'm doing, to have something different happen. So that's where that's just kind of a really annoying thing. And, I don't know, it's fine in the Home app, but just I don't like that somehow. Oh, and also when I went to the Home app, only like half the stuff appears. So I had to delete the rooms, and somehow like in the background, it re-imports the lights. Like it's just not good. And I mean, I don't have a real complaint or good thing here, but it's just not very good. I don't know how anybody would put up with this. That's not me.
Well, and the most amazing part is the Hue stuff is probably the best stuff out there, and it's still just not very good. Yeah, no, I mean, we were early on the streaming stuff, and we were maybe even earlier on smart home stuff is bad, and it continues to be really bad. Yeah, yeah, and I mean, absolutely, I will... absolutely no, like I get asked this sometime by friends and family where, you know, they'll ask me about some smart home stuff and start, you know, asking like what they should buy. And I try not to like be that guy who just like tells everybody exactly what technology to buy. But I do generally try to gently steer people away from the idea of buying a bunch of smart home stuff because it's going to end up being frustrating and bad.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I will say is that this wasn't a thing before when I... Oh, here's the other thing about Hue lights that sucks. Hold on. Go to Philips Hue. Send you a link.
I do love all of their... all their photography is excellent. I mean, they always depict...
Well, but it's
like,
all impractical.
Impractical setups, but they're very nice.
Like, who lives like this?
Nobody, like, but it's fun.
Like,
fun to
your living room looks like sherbet ice cream. Like, why is there nothing that's regular warm white?
It looks really nice. I especially like the outdoor setups are always really fun.
Yeah. But again, this is only in somebody who lives in Sea Ranch or in Sonoma and has a $19 million house. Would you ever possibly?
Right.
Anyway, closing this out. So I sent you a link to, my pick, not actually, this isn't a pick of the week. This is a product I hate. And these things went on sale by $3 after I bought them. Great. So if you narrow down using the filters on the right for bulb shape, go to Edison bulbs.
Bulb shape. Where the heck is that? Oh, here we go. See all Edison. Okay. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So you see four items now, right?
I do.
Can you, in 30 seconds, figure out the difference between ST23 and ST19?
Probably not. No.
I can't tell why one costs $10 more than the other. I really, really, really tried. I typed in ST19, ST23 Reddit, which is my trick for finding out why anything is the way it is in the world. Didn't work. I used a little compare tool. I opened both up side by side in tabs and went to the tech specs page. The ST23 ones output the exact same amount of light and are the same wattage, but are, I think, like 10% longer. I don't know. It's frustrating because it makes absolutely no sense. But I guess maybe a pick of the week. It's fine. It works. Because I had previously bought a Hue Edison bulb before, but I think it's the one that's $28 now and they've clearanced it out. It has one fixed color temperature and it's way too warm. Like it's meant to look like a vintage light bulb where it's real orangey. Mm. Anyway, the new one operates between, I think, 2000 Kelvin and like 43. So it fits their standard kind of like white ambiance range.
Yeah.
And it's pretty nice. It looks cool in a fixture where you don't have like where like the bulbs themselves aren't actually covered. So I guess good job.
So I have the what I guess would be the non-ambient version of these bulbs, because mine I have two and they don't
bulbs?
Yeah, and they don't change color at all.
So then is it really warm?
It's very warm. I'll tell you something about these bulbs is you know, these are meant to be indoor bulbs. I have them outside. Because we have in our driveway and at our front door, we have fixtures that they really are meant to have this kind of Edison style bulb in them. And so I kind of rolled the dice and put a couple of these Hue bulbs out there. And they've been out there for years now. And they're fine.
Eh, if they're enclosed.
They're sort of. They're mostly enclosed.
Okay. Yeah, I can't picture it. Take a picture and show me. But... these are fine. There are two other light fixtures here that I can't figure out how to open that I am curious. Like, they do look like they have standard bulb thingies. So anyway, TBD, like a lot of the smart home stuff is mostly fixed. But I've got, do you have any other Hue stuff on your, actually, so I have a couple more moving things, but there's one Hue related topic that came up, I think like a month ago, that's of relevance to you, which is that they're releasing some kind of update to, they're not expanding the number of lights that a bridge can handle, but they're doing a thing where the Hue app can address multiple bridges. Did you ever find out the details on this?
I've not yet. I've not really looked all that closely, and I don't think it's out yet. So I think some of the specific implementation details are still a little TBD. I mean, maybe the nice folks on Reddit have figured this out. I haven't looked in r/Hue yet, but yeah, one of the pain points has been if you have multiple bridges, you have to have separate Hue accounts linked to each. And one of the annoyances of that is something like the Amazon Voice Assistant skill, you can only link one Hue account to it, which means that you can only have one of your bridges linked to it. So, you know, like in my case, I, you know, would only be able to control like half of my Hue lights with the Amazon Voice Assistant, which is by far and away the most common way that I interact with the lights. And so because of that, I, you know, had to set up my whole Hubitat hub setup, which, you know, we've talked about before, which I mean, how many years have I had that now? I think it's been like maybe 4 years. Yeah, I think it's almost been exactly 4 years because I set all this up during the pandemic. And it's been remarkably stable, like knock on wood. But in theory, it sounds like something like this could potentially make it so that I don't need the Hubitat hub. I'm holding my breath, or I'm not going to hold my breath over this though, because when Amazon implemented Matter support for Hue, well, and Hue also adapted or adopted Matter, that also was theoretically a way that you could have multiple bridges associated to the Amazon Voice Assistant, but everything I read about with that made it seem like that was kind of a complete mess. so we'll see. Like even if this does come out and people say it works reasonably well, like I don't know, I'm not sure what I would gain by moving over to that, because I mean I've already bought this hub and it's just kind of doing its thing.
And then with the Hubitat setup, in the Apple Home app, is it just that all your lights appear? It's already done all the background work to make that happen?
Well, the Hue bridges are directly connected to HomeKit, because HomeKit does support having multiple bridges.
So the only reason Hubitat is required is to get Alexa support?
Correct. Yeah.
Yep. Got it.
Yeah. So if we were a Siri household, oh God, I forgot that when you say that now without the hey, it triggers it. then you wouldn't need something like the Hubitat hub, because HomeKit supports multiple bridges. It's just the Amazon stuff that doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a couple other quick moving bits. So server closet. I didn't have internet until Saturday. So you are using TP-Link? Are you using the TP-Link Deco?
Yep.
Okay. So I got an issue, or maybe you could talk me through this.
Okay.
So I was Wi-Fi only for a bit, and I just hadn't bothered to set up the server closet. And the server closet entails of... And this is probably a holdover from when I lived in Marin, where the power was less reliable due to just terrain and stuff. But the server closet includes a couple of UPSs, a Synology, a big old switch, a Mac Mini, and a few other things. But I didn't have internet until Saturday, despite having moved on Tuesday, because when I transferred my service to the new address, and when I plugged it in, like the Eero would just not get online. And this is my fault for not being an effective troubleshooter. I never tried to just directly plug a computer into the modem. But it's, yeah, the Eero would not get an IP. No matter, I tried multiple coax outlets in the apartment. I did a little reset pin on the Motorola modem. I did all that, just would not work. And then I was on the phone with Comcast Advanced Tech Support for a while. Also, Comcast, you know how everybody's just leaning super hard into these, it's not AI, but like these chatbots either, but these voice assistants over the phone that just make it so hard to speak to a person. Comcast has quadrupled down on that, where it literally, I'm normally not like a just smash zero, like I'll play the game for a little bit. This fucking thing would not let me talk to a person, and I'm like, oh, if I will literally dig a trench myself to get AT&T fiber into this building. Like, I mean, anyway, eventually talked to somebody, and they had to schedule an appointment to get somebody out here, and the appointment was available within like a day and a half. Like, it was not a problem, but the guy came over very nicely on a Saturday morning, and it, like, within 5 minutes, he said, oh, it was a provisioning issue. He got it working. And I was like, okay, great. I didn't really ask my question just because who cares? It's working now. Great. And then everything was fine. And then last night I was like, okay, let's unpack everything and let's get the server closet up and running. And it stopped working again. And I think, I don't even know if this is a thing, but can Comcast block a specific type of MAC address? Just because no matter what I did to the Eero, I even hard reset the Eero, it would not get online when plugged either into the switch, not a Nintendo switch, like a networking switch, or directly into the modem. It just will not get online. And then I plug my Mac Studio into it and it works fine. Plug the Eero into it, stops working. And I think I did that a dozen times last night, and eventually the Eero did work, and now I'm just terrified to touch it. So now I don't know, like, did Comcast for some reason like blacklist the Mac ID so that it's like, don't ever give this an IP address? I didn't know if it's that the Eero just, I don't know if the Eero sucks, and I've had a TP-Link Deco in my cart for the past few days, and I'm like, not sure, but like, the Eero's fine when it works. Like, I have no complaints there, really. So I don't know what to do. So, because I mean, I'm like, literally, I'm terrified to unplug it and it stops working again, because I don't know what I did or how many times I needed to power cycle all this crap for it to work. So I don't know what to do.
So I guess like a few questions before I can try to give you some advice. So you've actually had two issues. You've had like a Comcast provisioning issue.
I don't know.
Because you never tried plugging into the modem before the guy came out.
Correct.
Okay. And he could have just said he did something to kind of just get out of there.
It definitely worked. So I mean, whatever he did, I don't know. Or maybe it was that one extra power cycle. Like, maybe the ninth time was the charm. Like, I don't know why, but like, it worked. But he did something.
But when he was there and it worked, that was without your Eero, or that was with?
No, that was with the Eero. Like, there was still no. He even asked when he was trying to do the troubleshooting with me, and he's like, "Oh no, like it looks like it's online. Like, we're receiving a signal from the modem." He's like, "Do you have like an Ethernet cable, and like, do you have just a computer you can plug in?" And I, like, not being fully packed, and I'm like super groggy on a Saturday morning, was like, oh, where is my Thunderbolt to Ethernet dongle? And that was not good. So eventually he's like, okay, that's fine. We'll just keep trying to work on this. And it did. And within 5 or 10 minutes, it worked on its own after some amount of unplugging and replugging. So I don't know.
Okay. And in your cable modem, it doesn't have like a router of its own built into it, right? It's just a modem.
No. Okay.
That's my trouble with Eero was not exactly what you're describing, but similar in the sense that it just was inexplicably unreliable. Like in my case, it was my, you know, my iPhone, which is kind of my most commonly used device around the house, would just all of a sudden stop being connected to the internet. And I'd have to turn Wi-Fi off on the iPhone and turn it back on in order to get it to work. And I've never once had that problem with my TP-Link Decos or any non-Eero Wi-Fi equipment I've used. And if you, you know, if you look on r/Eero, there's a bunch of people with iPhones complaining about the same thing. So I don't know. Eero seems really, really great when it works, but you're not really left with all that many troubleshooting options when it doesn't. It's got a Apple vibe to it.
The app sucks because the app has such little utility when it's not working in that way. And also, let me send you a screenshot because there's something that really pissed me off about it. What do you think this means? So Eero now has a component called, because everything's a fucking subscription now, called Eero Plus. So when I was having a problem with my network, that's the thing that says, hey, need temporary internet access? Use Eero internet backup. So no Googling. Use Eero internet backup with an Eero Plus plan to stay connected while your wired internet is offline but still has power. What do you think that feature does?
Well, I have two guesses. One is that it's got a cellular chip in it, and it's going to connect to like a cell network, mm-hmm. which I don't think is the case. My second guess would be: doesn't Amazon, which owns Eero now, don't they have some sort of weird, like?
No, it's not Amazon Sidewalk.
Okay,
if your Echo Show or something is maybe too far away from your network, if somebody in the neighboring house has internet, it uses Sidewalk to create like a low power, low bandwidth, whatever.
Yeah, so
neither.
Reasonable guess though, right?
Totally. It is neither. So behind a paywall is basically, it's a thing that it allows you to walk over to your neighbors, ask them, hey, what's your Wi-Fi password? You pay Eero $10 a month for the privilege of it just repeating their network to you.
What?
Yes. That's fucking ridiculous. Because the cellular, like, that is absolutely a thing. Like, cellular failover network, like, there's a whole company named Cradlepoint. Like, there's many people that do that. It's more for enterprise and business setups because, I mean, just regular people aren't willing to pay that. So, no. So, the Eeros do not have backup cell chipsets in them or anything like that. It is a thing where it's gated behind a $10 a month subscription. You can just use your Eero as a repeater for your neighbor's Wi-Fi if you type in their password.
Weird.
Dumb.
Yeah.
And then also on the Eero app, like I was like just tapping through everything just to figure out like what reset or what setting can I do. And half of the app is full of things that are features that should not cost money that are locked behind a paywall. Like I was just like even while it wasn't working, I was like, oh, actually, how much bandwidth have I used recently? Because I was doing all that backup to Backblaze. I am now up to year 2022. Of my photos. It's a week and a half in, and this is excluding the week that my internet didn't work. If you want to see how much data you used more than 7 days ago, you have to pay them $10 a month. It's just so, it feels like Apple. Like it's very Apple-like in the sense that they're trying to get their money every which way. It's not, and the Eeros aren't cheap enough for this crappy of an experience to be the thing.
So I say this as somebody who like really wants to like Eero. Like I like the idea of Eero. I like the idea of just a very clean, simple network setup. But with that being said, I would just dump the Eero and I would move to, you know, basically anything else. Like what? What does the wirecoder recommend now?
But my problem is that I don't think this can really be a thing that I should worry about, because like for home security cameras I would, but TP-Link is I think it's a Chinese brand, and those tend to have not terribly great security. Not even just like if you think it's like a state government thing. Like, I'm not even saying that. I am saying that to a little bit of a degree, but there's been a, have you heard of a company called Wyze, W-Y-Z-E?
I have, yeah.
They make really cheap smart home stuff. They have had like 4 incidents in the past like 18 months where people who have their security cameras, you just see some random user's camera in the app. Like, they've had a lot of issues. Even the wire cutter, the second result, if you search for Wyze, is why we're pausing our recommendations of the Wyze smart security. Yeah. They've just, that is why I've been really hesitant about the TP-Link thing. And I think you said Google Wi-Fi was also kind of a no-go. Or you said it's kind of like you're like, it's not, it has caveats just like the Eero does.
No,
right?
No. My Google Wi-Fi was pretty solid. They went through some weird software stuff there for a while.
Why aren't you using it anymore?
They had some, I think, bad software update that then started giving me some trouble. But then that did get ironed out. I was also interested in updating just more modern Wi-Fi, because the Nest stuff hadn't been updated in a long time. But they've got the new, I think it's like Nest Wi-Fi Pro now, which I think reviews pretty well. So I don't know, maybe look at that.
Okay. Whenever I have some downtime, I'll maybe call Comcast and just like say, like, is it possible? Like, I just didn't never in all my years of like all like being familiar with this kind of stuff, I didn't know that like a cable modem can refuse to give an IP address or like let a certain MAC ID. Like, I never knew that the device could impact that, because like there's no other explanation, right? Like, if I plug my MacBook Pro or my Mac Studio directly into the modem, it works every time.
I mean, there are, and this is where I very, very quickly get out over my skis with networking stuff, but there are some settings within a router that sort of dictate how it's getting, like, I think both an IP address and like the DNS information from your modem. So it's possible mm-hmm. something got wonky there. Yeah, my experience with AT&T fiber's actually been kind of, it's been the opposite almost of yours, where, so the only modem that they offer, and you, like, you basically have to get theirs, right? Because like fiber modems are like,
well, because it's an ONT, right?
Yeah, exactly. It has a built-in Wi-Fi router, and there's like no option to, you know, not to get one that doesn't have one. And so like with my setup, you have to like go into the modem router thing, disable the router functionality, and like tell it, hey, pass along like whatever info you need to pass along to another router that's hooked up to it, and then have your router accept that information. And I remember when I switched over to fiber thinking like, oh geez, like this is like not gonna work, and I'm not gonna be able to figure out how to make it work. But it kind of, it like miraculously did, and has been like incredibly rock solid. I'm afraid to ever touch it, but yeah, it works. I mean, I would say with like the TP-Link stuff with me, like the app's not great. It they did do a complete refresh on it at some point. It's gotten better. But my number one thing is it's just so rock solid. Like, I don't remember the last time I've had to reboot any of my network stuff.
Well, but that's the thing with the Eero, like in my old apartment, like didn't touch. I don't think I ever had to reboot literally anything, like the Mac Mini, the Snow, like nothing for 6-9 months. Like, it was never an issue. Eh, we'll see. All right. And then the last bit here, what else goes in the server closet?
Well, not the TiVo anymore.
No. I'm going to send you a thing.
Get, what is the? Well, you mentioned your Synology before. You got a new one.
Did I get a new one, or did the old one break? My Synology doesn't turn on anymore.
Oh no. Like, this happened during the move?
Yeah, and again, short distance move.
So it was working, and then you moved, and it wasn't working.
Correct. Whoa. I didn't drop it. Like, I moved it myself. Mm. I didn't drop, like, So if you Google, if you just do a Google search for Synology 1815 Atom, A-T-O-M, apparently, because the Synologies use, like, the line of processors Apple or Intel uses for, like, was it still their NUX or the, like, their netbooks? It has an Atom processor. And apparently there's just a thing where this model of Synology, after like 4 or more years, will just stop turning on.
Oh, nice.
Because the processor just gives up.
Great.
So that, I don't, just because the part of that explanation that kills me, or that just doesn't comport, is that it's not like booting fully. Like, pressing the power button does nothing. The fans don't even try to spin up for a second. It's just like the power button, like, yeah. So I don't know. So one, I'm like, I'm super pissed. The famous last words. I'm not terribly worried that my data is gone, because I'm basically like, that's the reason why I sent you the screenshot with, from B&H. One, well, I'm mad, but I can't be that mad, because I forgot how old it was. I literally bought this Synology over 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, but the thing is, I really wish it would have failed in a progressive way. Not in the political sense, but
is this order from 2016? Is that like when I bought your other one?
Yes. Yeah. Or I'm assuming.
I think so.
So maybe not backup. Your model is not affected with this weird thing, but also maybe think about the fact that model is probably 1.5 years older than this, so it's getting approached close to a decade, so maybe make sure you have your backup set up right.
Yep.
So I mean, 8 years is not a bad run. Like, I'm not mad about it in that sense, but I do really wish there were more signs where, yeah. So that was $1,000 I wasn't really planning on spending this month.
Well, geez, your new one's got a AMD thing.
I mean, it's the same box. Like, it's the same thing. All they have is maybe hopefully a processor that doesn't just have like a fatal like hardware defect that shows up 3 or 4 years down the line. I guess maybe I'll count myself lucky that I got 8 out of mine. But yeah, I'm really, really gonna be fucking pissed if I lost some data. Because like none of it's irreplaceable, because I don't, like, again, I do have backups. I know you've been, and actually this probably reiterates your point of how you were admonishing me and mocking me for nuking my B2 backup of all my photos without having a clear path for fixing it.
Yep.
And again, that is still in progress, but it's like 85% of the way there. But yeah, I'm gonna be really fucking mad if I'm gonna have to kind of reconstitute most of that. But I do think, like, it's the same box, and I'm going to stick the same drives in the exact same order. Like, with the Synology, the operating system of the, like, the whole, like, DSM software thingy, it's stored on the drives themselves. So, like, in the same way that if your unit fails and they, like, replace it under warranty, you're not, like, you just stick the drives in, and theoretically, everything should just be like nothing happened. And if that's not the case, you're going to be able to hear me swearing from 15 miles away.
I mean, if you were moving, like, from this, like, if you were moving to a new unit of the same model, like, I totally agree. I don't see why that wouldn't work. But moving those drives to a model that's like almost a decade newer, I don't know. I mean, yeah, it seems like it probably should work, but have you looked it up? I mean, there's got to be the nice people on Reddit who have tried this too, right?
I don't know. I mean, I don't really have any choices right now.
What's on your, because your photos are somewhere else now, not on the Synology.
The photos are on there too. Like, that's where I was telling you that I wasn't that worried about the backup. Is that no? I do have a copy of all my photos on the Synology. I have like disk image clones of my Mac and MacBook Pro on the Synology. I have stuff that fell off a truck. I've got other stuff. That's what's on there.
But what's your online backup rebuilding from right now if the Synology is not working?
What do you mean? Because that's what I was telling you, is that I for latency reasons, I moved all my photos in terms of like how I access them in Lightroom to like a directly attached SSD. Because we had talked about the fact that I was bumping up against the 4 terabytes of space that had.
I guess it's lucky you did that then, right? Otherwise, wouldn't you be in a situation where the only place your photos were on the drives in your busted Synology?
Well, yeah, but that in that case, there's no, under that scenario, there's no way I would have nuked the B2 backup.
Oh, you only did that after you had your photos.
Yeah.
Just
because when I did that, the Synology was now my backup.
Yeah, I'd still say that's irresponsible.
again, it's fine. It's getting backed up now. So yeah, that was a very unpleasant morning.
Interesting. Yeah,
like what could have happened to it? Why now?
Technology's bad. Why does your new Synology have a PCIe slot and 2 NVMe slots? Do you know?
I think that's for like rapid caching.
So would that potentially help?
No, because it's not going to have terabytes worth.
Well, but you wouldn't terabytes loaded at like any given time.
After a big shoot, like I end up with like maybe 1 or 2 full memory cards. Like that's 120. I just took photos at the Chinese New Year parade, and that ended up being like 700 photos, and that's at 50 megs a pop is like 100 gigs. Anyway, fingers crossed. All right. Okay. All right, Apple, real quick.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess we kind of made loose reference to the new MacBook Airs earlier.
Well, yeah, so there's Gurman said last week that there was going to be no spring event. There were just going to be like direct announcements. The M3 MacBook Airs are out. Cool. They support 2 external displays. I actually don't remember that controversy, but yeah.
It has been announced, I guess, since, because Upgrade was talking about this week, how the new MacBook Airs with the M3 processor would be able to power 2 external displays with the lid closed, but that the base model MacBook Pro with M3 was not able to do that. It was limited to 1 external display no matter what. But it turns out that there is going to be a firmware or software update to that MacBook Pro to give it the same functionality as the MacBook Airs, which confirms that it's a software thing and not some, like Upgrade was speculating that, well, maybe like the display and the MacBook Air is like physically hooked up differently where it can like turn itself off in a way that the MacBook Pro can't or something like that. But it seems like that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, neat, I guess.
Yeah, but also a weird self-imposed software limitation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's the hardware is not really anything to write home about, and like the M3 is a very minor upgrade, so whatevs. Last week, Apple released the Apple Sports and the Apple Sport app, if you're in Britain, app last week. Any thoughts?
I've not downloaded it yet, so no, not really many thoughts.
You're not a betting man?
Oh, see, I actually think that part of it is silly, because I totally am one of those people where I am curious in the odds, but I don't ever bet, but I do think it's interesting. So I actually think having the betting odds in the sports app, like that would be something I would really appreciate and be interested in, even though I'm not actually betting. So I don't know. It makes sense to me.
I'm not going to, I don't think I have it in me to go through a full third defense of why this is bad, but in the same way that ESPN is allowing, what's the company they partnered up with to make ESPN Bet?
I forget, but yeah, one
Penn
of the
Entertainment. Mm-hmm. Like, it feels like, I guess no companies have a moral compass anymore. Like, Disney's gotten to a point, and so has Apple, where they're realizing that if they can make money, they will use that avenue. And I think just the prominence, like, I do take your point, and I find it interesting that betting odds are, and like, they had this also in a less amusing Ask Up Your Question about, like, what are the other reasons for betting odds that might be interesting? And somebody just had a point of, like, oh, like, knowing just who is favored to win the game. That's useful and kind of interesting data. But just if you look at screenshots, the prominence with which the betting odds are there is really strange and gross. And I just feel that coupled with the App Store guidelines and what is and is not allowed on the App Store, I think just maybe specific to the US, we're in kind of a weird spot with sports gambling, and I do think sports gambling is kind of a gross thing that has a lot of real world consequences and negatives that tend to ruin a lot of lives. I don't know. Like, I just, the normalization of that is very weird to me. And the fact that Apple is like, just like, that seems very late stage Apple.
Yeah. Doesn't bother me.
Yeah. And then, Apple Car's dead. I don't
know.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to push that to next week? Cause I think there's actually probably more to talk about there.
Sure. Yeah.
Or do you have anything right off the top of your head or not? Because we're at hour 35.
Yeah, no, not really.
Okay. Chef specials?
You're going to have to go first. I don't really know if I have one this week.
Well, my Amazon order queue for the last week is very long. Not a fun stuff, just like a random stuff that's half broken.
I guess actually speaking of, okay, Amazon purchases, I actually can't come up with one. So we went on a trip a couple of weekends ago, I guess now, and the previous technology setup for the new housemates has been the eldest new housemate, she gets to use my iPad Pro, which, even though I, you know, am not some, like, you know, huge iPad user or anything, still, you know, makes me a little nervous giving a 4-year-old a, you know, pretty expensive tablet. And sure enough, like, she has dropped it and stuff before, which, you know, I feel like I keep a mostly cool head about, but don't love. And then I had bought a Amazon Fire tablet, like, some number of years ago, just using, like, Amazon points, because I what was I going to do with it originally? I was going to, like, install, like, a cocktail, like, recipe app, and just have that, like, sit at my wet bar as, like, a cocktail kind of catalog thing, and I basically never ended up actually doing that. But I, you know, ended up having the younger new housemate use that for, like, when we were on planes watching videos and stuff. But that thing, it's you know, it's a number of years old now. It's, like, frustratingly slow. So, like, basically what I'm saying is, like, neither kid's tablet setup was very good. So we got each of them one of these, which is the Fire HD 8 Kids. Yeah, I guess so. One quick caveat is, I guess these things are like normally $150. I guess we got them on sale because we only paid $100. And we just used Amazon points, so we actually didn't pay any cash. But anyway, these things are really great. They're so much faster than that old Fire tablet that I had, which has been really, really nice. And because they're the kids version, they come in this kind of fun, soft case that also doubles as a little stand that you can, you know, put it down on a tray table or whatever. And then it's also got this, you know, kind of kids friendly UI that sits over the top of the standard Fire OS or whatever they call it. This has been a really nice little setup for the kids watching videos and stuff when traveling.
Interesting. Yeah, like, because wasn't the old Fire Kids, the Fire tablet that you had, wasn't it like slow from day one?
Yeah, it was never my favorite. But yeah, these new ones,
I guess,
ones
good,
are
good on them for having made it or managed to make at that price point that it's actually decently speedy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're, you know, definitely not like iPad speed or anything. But yeah, they're, you know, a lot faster than that old Fire tablet.
Mm-hmm. What's this now?
Oh yeah, I sent you.
Is this what a Cocomelon is?
Mm-hmm. Or who's and my daughter's interesting use of her headphones.
Well, no, she wants to make sure the tablet can hear.
Anyway, yeah, these things are fun. So
wait, are these headphones with a built-in headphone splitter?
Yeah. Yeah, they're like
why do kids get all the cool technology?
I know.
I'm sure many back in the iPod era, everybody would have killed for that.
They're like, I think they're like the Wirecutter's like budget kid headphone pick. I originally was thinking like, oh, it'd be really nice for her to have like little kids Bluetooth headphones, because like, how great is it to not deal with like the cord and stuff? But they were quite a bit more expensive.
It's just another thing to remember to keep charged.
Well, and she basically never uses them, so I'm glad we went with the least expensive option. But yeah, no, they're good.
Wait, so is she listening to it out loud, or she does not care that she can't?
No. We would never ever subject the world to any kind of tablet sound, let alone Cocomelon. So no, she watches it with no sound. Yeah. No, I know. And she'll do that for like on our flight home from Hawaii last summer. She did that for like 4 straight hours.
So is it just,
I don't have any explanation. Well,
this feels like sometimes people watch it's like people who watch Seinfeld before going to bed, 'cause they just want to see their face. It's that's interesting that she doesn't even, because I always thought Cocomelon, like, it's not known for animation quality.
No, certainly
it's
not.
More like, it looks kind of like a college design student's like low like complexity rendering, like, yeah, first project. But I always thought it was about the ultra catchy songs. And I said catchy, not good, but
yeah. Yep. No, you're not wrong.
Mine, I Yeah, I don't really have much. Fine, I'll give this a go. Why does it keep doing this? It is the Simple Human 8-foot tension pole shower caddy, because I have nothing else to offer right now. I don't know. It's fine. In the similar way that OXO for kitchen items is the appropriate default place to start when you're looking for something that you need for the kitchen, Simple Human is the same way for household things. And yeah, this is good.
Interesting. So this goes like floor to ceiling?
Yeah, and it's very adaptable, and it's well built. It doesn't feel like rickety or crappy. Like the old apartment, I had one that's the Threshold brand from Target, and this is like the step up. This is the upgrade pick from that, and it's fine.
Nice.